Hello, welcome to the Poolside Polymaths podcast,
where we dip our toes into the infinite pool of art and science.
Join us,
Merritt,
Monsi,
and Marcus for a deep dive into the creative imagination.
Welcome to the Poolside Polymaths podcast. We are the 3Ms, the M Cubes, Merritt, Marcus, and Monse. And we're back with part two of our incredible interview with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Hello, everybody. Here I come to save the day.
On the first Sire Party, we asked our community who did they want to see on our next one. And most of them were like Neil deGrasse Tyson. So yeah, we made it happen.
So now that we had Neil deGrasse Tyson on one of the SciArt parties, we actually recorded him and we thought about some of the things that he said. And we wanted to talk about that today on the podcast because he said so many really remarkable things about art and science that were inspiring to us.
Okay, before we jump in, I want to take a second to introduce our special guest. Dr. Tyson is currently the director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City, a role he's enjoyed for over 25 years. Alongside this role, Dr. Tyson has become one of the most prolific science communicators alive today. He has published books such as Death by Black Hole and Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, as well as hosted and produced the Star Talk podcast and award-winning Cosmos, a revival of the celebrated show by another great science communicator, Carl Sagan. We hope you enjoy listening to him talk about all things science and art. Let's go. We heard that you were in a dance troupe.
So that was 50 pounds ago. It was not the Bolshoi, but it was three separate performing dance companies. So the performance element of that was, I think, important. Otherwise, it would just be a dance class, right? But it's a dance class where you have to look good, you know, be graceful. And for me, the juxtaposition of strength, flexibility, agility, but also grace, all right? Because I also used to wrestle, and you don't have to be graceful in that. You just have to be strong and agile. The dance brought on a whole other layer of attention to what every muscle of your body is doing. And for those dancers among you out there, you surely know there's no shape like getting into dancing shape. And one of my big frustrations, I guess I can tell it now that it's 50 pounds ago, was there was a woman I had to like lift over my head and make it look like it was effortless, but that was hard. And, you know, she was not the thinnest of the women that I had to lift. So I went to the gym and I said, okay, let me get a little more strength going in here. And we did it so that when she jumped into my arms, I grabbed her at her ankle so that she can help propel herself up over my head. So all I had to do is be rigid holding her leg and she used her thigh energy to then pop herself up. And once she's up and locked, then that's better. I didn't have, so it looked like I lifted her up, but in fact, she did have to work. And that way it looked graceful briefly.
But that's what I think. Like I tell all the dancers, I'm like, look, the benefits of knowing physics.
Yes, of course.
You don't have to be in the studio that much. Like you save so many hours by knowing physics.
The physics is in everything. I mean, the physics folks out there who've majored in it will know this. And the weird thing is, and I hate to sound physics snobby about it, but you really have to take physics to deeply understand what the hell is going on in this world, the matter and motion and energy. And once you take physics, the world looks completely differently to you, right? It's no longer just a table with legs. It's a force diagram, and the legs are
and the friction
weight, and there's vectors, and it's as though you stripped away certain distracting detail about the world around you, and you see how it actually works, and why things don't fall over. If they do fall over, why they do, and so. Yes, it can infuse every walk of life. I want to change the culture where, and you know this is true because you've been to these parties, where you're at a party, an artsy party, right? And there are artists there, and they got some fashion sense about them.
We're
and
dancing.
If you go in coming from the geek world, you're kind of, you know, you're not as cool as they are, right? Okay, fine. You're used to that, being a geek. But then you're in the corner, and then there they are talking about something that you may or may not know something about, maybe some, and then if the subject ever gets to math, this little gathering of people might say, often say, math, oh, I was never good at math, I sucked at math, and they will chuckle while they say that. Whereas, let's say you have a geeky party, and you have to invite some artists. And the artist goes into the corner, and you're talking about whatever the latest Nobel Prize for the discoveries of black holes, and someone says, oh, have you read the latest novel? And if you reply, as the geeky person in the corner, if you reply, oh, I was never really good at nouns and verbs. they would laugh. There is no room for you to have the illiteracy to equal their innumeracy at your respective parties. So this gathering here today are people who have real presence in both communities. Yeah. And I think you can help change that culture. And you should never be proud or chuckle at what you don't know. You mm-hmm. should be embarrassed by what you don't know. You should say, oh, I didn't know that, and go home that night and look it up and study it. All right?
We have everything on our phones.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes. Oh, sorry. Am I that old?
Is that what you do? I mean, you know, yes. Like,
you don't have to go home, pull out your phone, and dig it out. Yes.
Oh, well, yes. Yeah, you can just, like, look it up and be like, okay, if I don't know something, you better go into your phone, and Google knows everything now. So
Yeah. Google knows almost everything, right?
Almost everything, yes.
Yes, physics isn't everything. I do believe in this. And as I mentioned in the previous episode, like, I use physics all the time to help me win my ballet training and to enhance my skills.
Yeah, physics is also really fun for synthesis, all the different kinds of synthesis you can do using your knowledge of frequencies. I almost wish that you had to know more about the Fourier transform in order to do it, but you actually don't have to know very much about the Fourier transform.
But in your soul, you know.
In your soul. You yeah, right. In the soul of the music. Is the Fourier transform.
For what transform?
Fourier. Jean-Jacques Fourier? So Fourier transform is you can resolve many continuous functions given the right conditions into infinite sums of sines and cosines. And that's really nice because sines and cosines are like the most basic kinds of waves. And so, like, the idea is that if you can resolve any function into like an infinite sum of sines and cosines, well, sines and cosines are also really they're sound waves, right? Like, sound waves end up being sine and cosine functions, and so that means that you can kind of create any sound because sound is like roughly a continuous function with regard to like the pressure waves in air, and so you can create lots of different sounds by various sums of sines and cosines with different amplitude, and that's what like gives you timbre in instruments. That's what makes a saxophone sound different than a clarinet is like the presence or absence of certain frequencies at certain amplitudes or certain volumes, and synthesis means that you actually just take this on a computer and you play around and almost manually with the characteristics of these waves by adding in frequencies, by modulating using other sine or cosine waves, or like taking sounds and then subtracting different frequencies from them to get other sounds. It's a lot of fun, and it's a really deep rabbit hole.
Oh, thank you so much for the side note, Marcus.
No problem.
This is such a great lead into the next quote.
Yeah. Oh, isn't it? There's a way in which society seems to accept innumeracy in a way that we wouldn't accept illiteracy. Mm-hmm. And I know that gets me really tight because this is the kind of thing I like talking about.
Yeah.
And I like talking about it casually. Mm-hmm. And I like thinking in these terms. And there are definitely times where I know I've felt excluded. Because somebody will say, what are you interested in? And I'll be like, well, I was reading some math. And then immediately you get like I'm bad at math, or I'm never good at math, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what? Don't disqualify yourself and don't disqualify me. Like, maybe I'm going to say something interesting. Like, listen a little bit more before you start hating. So, the way in which it's like, we can kind of make it cool to know about a Fourier transform in the way that it's cool to know about the latest book or to have a thought on the writing quality and the structure of, you know, the most famous TV show. It's kind of something that, you know, I would like to see. And I think that the world would be better for if we kind of had that regard. And I would say that in my life, I've started to see that turn around. Mm-hmm. It actually feels like maybe an effect of social media, and that some people who want to rack up followers but are interested in math have like found clever ways to make math more palatable in terms of infographics and such. But then somebody pointed out to me that I might just be hanging out with more nerds than I used to. And so it seems like it's cool, but actually it's not. I don't know. I'm agnostic.
I think it's the latter.
Merritt, do you hang out with more nerds than you used to, or no?
Yeah, I definitely embrace the dorkiness. My mother actually would say, she was like, Merritt, dorks rule the world, so embrace it.
Monte hangs out with nothing but cool people who speak 7 different languages each.
No.
Monte's like, the one who has to catch up in her circles.
No. Like, the people that I hang out with, I usually find inspiring. So if inspiring in the way that whether that's something that I'm also interested in, or if they're just like so passionate about what they're talking about, I could listen to anybody talk. And like if they're just like getting super energetic and trying to explain the reason why they love doing what they do and how they started getting into it, that's something that I could listen to people talk about that forever. So like if you, as if you were saying, Marcus, if you got to a place and you started talking about math, I could listen for like as long as you want to continue like sharing, because it's like, I don't know if that's something that makes you want to continue learning and wants you to, like, that's something that keeps you curious. I'm gonna be curious about your curiosity, and I think that's one of the ways that I like to connect with people. Like if your passion sparks something in me, like some sort of curiosity, that's something that inspires me it to continue sharing what I do, because that might also creates curiosity or sparks something in another person. So I think, well, yeah, I mean, whether that's cool people, nerd people, or whatever tag people might have, I'm always happy to listen.
Yeah, Merritt seems, or sorry, Monse seems to have a well-balanced social life.
You're like, yes, Mom.
And the next quote is,
for me, people invest a lot of their time and energy, sometimes money, in search of the meaning of life on the premise that it's there under a rock for you to discover, or you just have to look behind a tree and there's the meaning of life. And I think that's misguided, because you have the power to create meaning in your life. And as you build the meaning of your life, life then has meaning. So you don't discover it, you manufacture it. And in that way, you are in control of how much meaning arises in your life. And you will never say to yourself, oh, I've spent my whole life looking for meaning, I've never found it, only to then be disappointed. And so for me, meaning comes from making the lives of others more meaningful, all right, helping others. Yeah. To achieve their potential. I can say that as an educator, because that's what I am, and that's fundamental to what I do. If you're a parent, it would be making sure your children are have the fullest expression of love and opportunity that you can give them. So then you have meaning because you know you've given meaning to others. And if you create a project, like I said, that you know will outlive you, or even if it doesn't outlive you, if you always wanted to do something and then you did it, that's meaning. So I would say, by the way, there are many religious people who have religion because the religion gives them meaning. And that can work for some people. I don't have a problem with that. I'm just saying, for everyone else who's in search, why not pause and create it?
Okay, so from what Neil deGrasse Tyson said about creating meaning, I really like the way he put it in the way that many times we are trying to look for meaning outside ourselves, and we're trying to look for answers and asking people and trying to follow what society says and what we've learned from before. And but at the end, we have all of these answers inside of us. And by that is like, throughout our lives, we're trying to find out who we are, and by being ourselves and bringing all of our lives and our energy to the world, we can start creating meaning. And something that I think I found this lovely in how he put it, that if we start helping other people find their own meaning, I think that's something that also makes your own life meaningful, whether that's doing what you love, whether that's I think I repeat this a lot, but I truly believe in that. If you're truly going towards your dreams, and if you're being yourself and just doing the best with what you can and trying to help others and spreading kindness, and just if you are really into something, what we were just talking about, the people that you're surrounding yourself with, if you're really into a topic and you find this inspiration around you, you can get inspired with that and start creating something from your own perspective. The moment that he mentioned that as educators or as parents or as friends or as coworkers or partners or whatever it is, you can help others and you can influence others by what you learn and with what you've been through in your own life. So I think that also goes back to your individuality can really have an impact on others. And that's only something that you can create, and that only comes from within you. So I think that's something beautiful that can connect you to other people. And if just by being yourself, you can help others in whatever you create. And what we mentioned also at the beginning with the examples of Beethoven and Van Gogh, if they wouldn't have been alive, what they created wouldn't be something we could see today. It's the same way that they created that from within themselves, and now we as creators and people from our Sarah Party community, that's what we are also striving to do. We're trying to find and bring the best out of each person that's part of this community. We're trying to help other people find the reason why they are here and they're able to create, and by that they'll find something meaningful to start doing in their lives, something that sparks a light in them to continue doing things. And what better way to do that than being able to inspire other people too.
Absolutely. The great British think tank of the 20th century, Monty Python, had a wonderful movie about the meaning of life. It's a film, everybody should watch it. It's so inspiring.
Item 6 on the agenda, the meaning of life.
It can be reduced to 2 fundamental concepts. 1, people are not wearing enough hats. 2, matter is energy.
I feel like one of the things that's always helped me to create meaning in my life tangibly is how one manages execution and making things reality. And there are lots of exercises about how to kind of identify what your dreams are and figure that out. And then the way to make it exist is really mundane things like calendar and routine and being able to arrange life in such a way that you can do the same thing with consistency every day so that you can grow in your skill set and in, the value you add in a given world. And I feel like that's a little bit under the hood of when people talk about, you have to define your dreams and then you have to go do it and take action and hard work. It's like, well, what does that look like? And it's actually the really boring things, the mundane things, the details, the stuff where putting in and doing work that isn't necessarily pretty or sexy or attractive just becomes normal. So sometimes my roommates or people I'm around call it, when I'm playing the saxophone, they call it the unbearable kind of practicing, where I'm sounding really bad, but that's how you make your tone large, or that's how you, get to some extended technique, is by being really bad at it. And it really sucks to listen to, but eventually it grows over time, becomes something that's a distinctive offering.
Mm-hmm.
That gift is something that you can, that you work hard at, that you kind of sit in routine and conquer boredom and conquer sleep and kind of conquer the self in order to get done. And then you can kind of move forward and really offer that to the world and inspire others.
And that important part of knowing you've given meaning to others, for myself, I know I was going through a difficult period in my life a couple years ago where I was just struggling, and I just made this motto for myself, which was I am free and I give hope. So the first part was I'm free to give me that freedom. I'm free of stereotypes. I'm free to screw up. I'm free to be me. I'm free to, whatever. But the second part was and I give hope, which was my like that fire and that fuel that really got me like jumping out of bed every morning, which is, okay, any step forward that I make, even if I don't make it in the end, like any step forward that I make, like trying to pursue both science and art, hopefully, you know, I want this to create hope and inspiration for others. So like if others can see me taking one step forward, they can be like, oh God, if she can do it, then we can definitely do it, right?
Yeah.
And so that was that little part of making, seeing, being like, oh, okay, how is this going to be beneficial for other people, and giving that, you know, emphasis on others was just like found, helped me find my fuel that just gave me tons of energy.
Yeah, I'd love to add this, that actually, like your story, Merits, is in like the book Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls in our second volume, and just seeing how many, like thousands, and well, now it's millions of girls that have our copies, and they read your stories, like, of course, like all these amazing stories, but then like you see the pictures of the little girls dressed with their tutus and with their lab coats, and just like showing how that a story, like seeing like, oh, like if she could do it, I can do it too. So I think that's something that like this story, like being public, that's something that you can notice, and something that can also like motivate you when you're not feeling like very yourself or whatever that is. And I think that's something that I like to think about too, is that we also never know who are we inspiring. So that we can continue like working and doing things, and we never know who's looking up to us. So I think that's something, like even though that we might never know, or there might just like suddenly come this random person, let you know like, hey Marcus, like you've been inspiring me for such a long time, and you might not even know who this person is. So I think that is also a way of creating meaning, that the more you are yourself and the more you truly are vulnerable as a human, and other people are like trying to also go through the same situations, and they know a little bit about yourself and are just like, okay, like if this person could do it, I can also do that. So I think that's something, that's another way of creating meaning. And it might not be something that many people might see, but as long as you know that you're doing your best, and there might just be one little person looking up, I think that's something, that's a great way of creating meaning for yourself and for others.
Yeah. The new question I have on my, I have it on my phone screen, which is like, how can one change people's lives in like 30 minutes?
Wow. 30 minutes.
I know. It's just a thought. It's just like a thought experiment.
I step on their foot really hard. I don't know. Like, a lot.
Wow. In 30 minutes.
I don't know. It's just like a thought experiment, right? Like,
yeah, you have to watch more horror movies.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
have you ever seen the movie Saw?
Oh, man. Now it's got a whole new twist to it.
Oh, man.
What's the biggest challenge that you faced during the science research, or I guess outside of science research as well?
Yeah, there are many, I would say, but it would be retaining confidence in my own abilities in the face of others who did not. You know, people see me and say, oh, you're successful, you're this. And I can just, by the way, you need an honest assessment of your own abilities. Otherwise, you live a delusional life. I had what I judged to be an honest assessment of my abilities, my interests, my ambitions. And then there are people who say, oh, why don't you become an athlete? Or why don't you become this or that? And people telling me, believing they're doing me a favor, by directing me to places where they're more familiar seeing someone with dark skin, okay? Mm-hmm. Substitute more familiar seeing a woman in some other. So you can substitute any underrepresented identity in that role, and there'll be people telling you what you should do versus what you want to do. Mm-hmm. And for me, the greatest challenge was maintaining the reserve of energy necessary to continually overcome society's urges to have me do something different from what I actually wanted to do with my life. And I think to myself, what beauties of this world were never realized? What beautiful art, what beautiful creations of this world were never realized because the person who would have done it ran out of fuel.
Yeah.
Do you have that commitment? You know, and the public reads about science discoveries or missions that land on the moon or on asteroids, and you read about that. But what you don't read about is that these people have been at it for a decade. Oh my God, they have to propose for it and bam, lay out the experiments, and they're busting their ass. That's most of what science is. It's not the discovery. You've got to love the journey. And if you don't love the journey,
4 years of my PhD was like, exactly. You got to start over.
You don't love the journey. Same with an artist. It's the journey. Yeah. Come on now. You've got to love with existing with your hands dirty, your fingernails. This is because as Edison said, genius is 90% perspiration and 10% inspiration. Okay, the perspiration part is let me do this and let me slog through it and let me recover after I fail. Yeah. That's what it is. My first book, I have a folder of the rejection letters from publishers for my first book. Then ultimately I wrote a book that was a number one bestseller on the New York Times list.
It
was there for like a freaking long time. Okay, obviously the In a Hurry, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry book.
Yeah.
So to just look at that and say, I'm glad I didn't lose confidence in myself. And I want to be very clear here. This is not an exercise in, let me just think I'm great, even if I'm not great. Okay, mm-hmm. You've got to get out there and make honest measurements of your talents relative to others who are in the power of making decisions over you. Because if you don't make an honest assessment and you're not really as good as you think and you don't get the opportunity that you think you deserved, then you are blind to the fact that, no, you didn't deserve it. Okay, so is it your family always telling you you're great? Okay, you got to filter that somehow. All right, is it your enemies always telling you you're bad? That's bad too. If you're good, but people tell you you're bad, that could pull you. So the people who tell you everything bad and the people who tell you everything good are equally not good in your arc. You want accuracy in your assessments. Otherwise, you lead a delusional life. Do you do in life what you're good at, or do you do in life what you love most? And often what you're good at is something that happened sort of natively to you, you know? Yeah. Okay, you were good at art from early on, or drawing, but really you want to be a sculptor. And so people want you to do what you're good at. Okay, here's in my experience, if you do what you love, even if you start out not being particularly good at it, if you do what you love, you will then do that your entire life and you'll become better at it than whatever it was that you were good at without having tried. And as a minimum, you lead a happy life, as a minimum, because you're doing what you love. And as they say, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, so many brilliant things that he's just said here. I mean, again, he talks about, having to fight against or being resistant to when you feel the pressures from other people telling you that what you should do and what you shouldn't do and what you can do and what you can't.
Yeah, I feel like we're the part of society that's telling you can do more. So like, listen to this part of society. What's that polymath, baby?
Two hands up. Yeah, and I love this part where he is saying that we have to like accept failure, but keep on like trying. I love this quote from Michael Jordan that he said, like, I can accept failure. Everyone fails at something, but I cannot accept not trying. So failure then becomes the means to an end rather than an end of itself. So in other words, failure is a part of the journey towards that success. So like everyone fails at one time or another, but the courage is like the part, mm-hmm. like you need that courage in order to continue and just like trying in order to just like keep on going.
I also love this part where he's like, yeah, you don't want to be around people who, you know, tell you you're bad, but also the ones that only tell you that you're just good. And aren't kind of brutally honest with the framework. So, yeah, it was a good point from him saying, you know.
Yeah, I really love that part about honest measurement because I think that's another kind of key improvement strategy. And it's also one of the things that people who have separate non-overlapping interests suffer with because they're in a lot of these fields, I mean, certainly in the fields Merritt and I are into, the standards are very high and very exacting. And those standards are given to us by both history and by the high level of competition in each of these fields. And so if you're going to perform at level and you're going to actually bring something novel, it's like you have to compete against people who are doing only one thing and they're doing it all the time. And there's definitely an advantage that comes from having a different store of knowledge to bring to bear into a field. But the raw hours that somebody's putting in on one thing that you're dividing between two things can be a setback, and it has to be managed. And there's one school of thought that says, well, that's not the point. You're not really competing against those people. You're kind of making your own lane, and that's fair enough. But then who do you look up to? What is this? What is excellent? How is excellence defined in that lane? And having to create and set your own standards in order to maintain that is a really, really non-trivial part of the process. And I know for me, it's been really investigating what is the connection for me between math and music. And now, and given that I found that for me, how do I communicate that to people? And how do I communicate that in a way that will earn the kind of respect or validation and shows respect and honor to, you know, the fields from which I come, without talking nonsense. Like they're just very high standards to uphold. And you know, everybody has to work that out for themselves. The cool thing, the fun thing, and also the scary thing about the hyphenate life is that you both have to walk the path and you have to build the path at the same time. That's oftentimes how you get to new things, but it means it's a lot of work, and it's work that isn't always well defined, and that can be a challenge existentially.
Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of opinions and inputs along the way. So it's always, I'm always a believer of like listening to everything, listening to all the critique, listening to everyone's comments. And then, you know, you kind of manage it sort of at a distance, you know, you pick and choose and be like, you know, but also being always receptive to the comments that can help you grow.
You're like taking them objectively.
Yeah, like never taking it quite personally. Like, I always love the brutal honesty rather than...
Exactly.
I really don't want it sugar-coated, you know? Like, if it's terrible, let's just discuss that it's terrible and then let's figure out a game plan to make it less terrible.
Yeah, exactly.
If you could work with an artist, dead or alive, who would it be and what would you do?
Ooh. Wow. I think I would work with one of the great poets. I don't know, maybe Emily Dickinson or it's someone who wants to use words to turn something you take for granted in their poem becoming extraordinary. And just some perspective. Using words, because I like words. I also write, and so maybe I'd give a different answer if I also were a painter, but I'm not a painter. I like to write. And so the poet distills the essence of the world and lays it down on a page and forces you to value things that you previously probably missed because it was hidden in plain sight. I'd want to work with them to become better at doing just that.
What artists would you guys like to work with? Would you guys like to collaborate with? Hot take.
I'd love to collaborate with Emma Watson. Like her as a writer, as an actress, as an activist, as a feminist, as a woman, as a human being. I think that she is so congruent with what she thinks, says, talks, does. She is someone that I love collaborating with, and whether that's creating your project to help girls just like children in general, being able to help children in general write and create workshops where they can develop their artistic skills and share their emotions and being able to tell their stories and know that they're worth it and increase their self-awareness and self-love, I think she is the person that I'd love to collaborate with.
Mm. Mary, what about you?
Well, I want Iris Van Herpen to design the next costume. So she's this amazing designer who, like, creates these, I mean, they're insane, like, these amazing designs using physics. Like, literally, it looks like the designs are, like, evaporating or, like, they're skeleton. It's, like, it's insane. I mean, I can't describe it. But, yeah, I want her to design the costume that I would dance in on the moon.
Flex, low-key flex, nothing special.
Oh, yeah, you know, oh, just over there in the moon. Let's see if the venue's open. Just yeah.
Nothing special.
Check availability.
Yeah. Yeah, I would love to just hang out with, like, Salvador Dali.
Oh, yeah.
He's my guy. When I was growing up, we had the hallucinogenic Toreador, a reprint of it, just hanging in the living room, and I would stare at it for hours, and now it's the background of my laptop. And I just love his ability to just instantiate these worlds, and these worlds have so much meaning, but they're so dreamlike and strange. So he's one, and then I'm going to do a second one, and that is so. I really like. I don't know if you guys have ever seen the movie Akira, and it's like this really, really beautiful movie. The director was this guy named and he also wrote the manga. It was like Katsuhiro Otomo, and I've been recently kind of into animation because I was working on a song and I was thinking about getting an animated music video to it. And I started learning about animation and how that process all works. And you know, when you get into that world, people are like, this is the masterpiece. Like, this is it. And it's like, why? It's because they dealt with so much detail. And they worked so hard on every little aspect. And it's just like, wow, this is gorgeous to be able to tell the story this way, all of the choices made, all of the details filled in, all of the ways that the world becomes rich and the richness of that world deeply informs the story and the sensory experience. It's like, I love to work with people who think about art and creativity like that.
Yeah.
Oh, and the third one, mm-hmm. there's this great singer, and he sang this song and went like this. Why are there so many songs about rainbows and what's on the other side? Rainbows are visually. Y'all want to hear the rest of the song? Why are you laughing? The series.
Yes, please, please, go ahead. This is our new intro now.
I forgot the rest.
No, don't stop.
Rainbows are visions, but often illusions. And rainbows have nothing to hide. This is the best part of the melody. This part is beautiful. So we've been told, and some choose to believe it. What? That's killing songwriting. I know they're wrong. Wait and see. Someday they'll find it. The rainbow connection. Why did he put that note in there? Wow. The lovers, the dreamers, and me. The lovers, the dreamers, and me.
I love you, Marcus.
Kermit the Frog. Yeah.
That's so great.
Yeah, collaborate with Kermit.
Yeah, there you go. This might be the step to eight happening.
Yep.
If you had to name a planet other than the name George, like William Herschel, what would you name it?
Ooh, well, I like to honor naming schemes. So planets are named for Roman gods. So I don't have a problem with that. But I'm not so mythology fluent that I say, you know, here's a god we've overlooked for so long. Mm. You know, I'm not there yet. So I'd have to think about that one. What I would name Earth. But what I would do is I would take a cut at renaming all the constellations, just updating them. You know, yeah. What's this with a hunter with a bow and arrow? You know, that now people have guns, so you give them a gun because that's what they were back then. He was hunting, okay? Let's be real about this, okay? And I would invent some new I would invent some new constellations, things that are relevant today. So not centaurs or creatures that they were imagining then. So there's a set of stars that is in the shape of a V. I would call that the ice cream cone, because I like ice cream. Conus Major, and then you have Conus Minor. Conus Major. So and you'd have like the Tesla up there. It would be an automobile, an electric automobile. So just update all the constellations to matter to us today, and maybe we'd have more people interested in the night sky.
I'm for that. Also, everything's like 4 stars, and they're like,
oh, it's embarrassing. Don't get me started. You know, telescopium that has 2 stars in it. Okay, you got to fill in all the rest. I got one for you. Triangulum. Guess how many stars that has? 3. Okay, any 3 stars in the sky makes a triangle. So this is like non-creative. By the way, the less creative constellations tend to be in the southern hemisphere. Mm-hmm. Because to the naming scheme that we use today, those mm-hmm. people who did that didn't get to the Southern Hemisphere until much later. In fact, they got there only at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. Mm. So constellations mm-hmm. in the Southern Hemisphere tend to have industrial things. So there's a draftsman's table, okay?
Really?
There's a microscope. There's the telescope. There's a sextant. There's an octant. Okay, these are navigational tools. Yeah. So they tend to be more technological in the Southern Hemisphere, relevant to what was going on in their day. The Northern Hemisphere is laden with Greek and Roman legends. By the way, Islam is deeply represented in the sky. This is our homage to all the important cultures that contributed to our understanding of the universe, where 2/3 of all stars that have names have Arabic names. And coming from primarily the golden age of Islam 1,000 years ago. So in my field, we're very aware and sensitive to how cultures have contributed their creative thinking to our modern understanding of the world.
In an interview, you had dreams of transforming into Geek Man, a superhero who flies around to save geeks from bullies. So what would that superpower actually be like? Or what does that...
Well, at the time, I wasn't very imaginative, but I knew I was bigger than most kids my grade. And if I wasn't the biggest kid in the class, I was like the second biggest. So bullies in my grade, bullies, they weren't outlawed yet in schools. So every school had bullies, right? And I don't know why it didn't occur to anyone to report the bully to the principal. I don't know why that was not a thing. Always, what are you going to do with the bully? Well, maybe I'll punch him, but then he'll pummel you. Well, I was big enough and strong enough, and I also studied martial arts, and I was limber.
You had the wrestling. You also now have the grace. So,
yes, I could kick some bullies' ass. That would be my superpower. I would just land in front of them and just intimidate them or kick their ass and save the geek from getting pummeled. But later on, I'd be a little more cerebral about it, and my superhero would be the ability to read people's minds. Mm. Then you would know in advance whether they're about to commit a crime, and then you could prevent it. And so that seems to me to be way better than jumping in front of bullets that are getting shot at you, bending steel. That's not just.
Let's go the step ahead.
Just go a little bit ahead of that, and then you're good. That I thought that was a better power than Hulk smashing things and Thor's hammer. You know, you're too late. I got there ahead of you. We don't need you anymore.
Boom. And
before I wanted to be a superhero, superhero I liked the most was Mighty Mouse. Okay.
Okay.
Timey cartoon, Mighty Mouse. So he was a mouse and he had a cape and he had big chest and there was his girlfriend was always in distress. And so he would fly, and while he was flying to save his girlfriend, he would sing opera. Here I come to save the day. He was, and I said, that's cool. All right. You know, Superman hang on his way to save people. That's a whole other show.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us, everyone who's listening. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on what do you think lies at the heart of science and art. Have you felt the pressure that you had to choose between science and art as well? We'd love to hear your thoughts on our socials at @SciArtParty.
Okay, stay strong, stay creative, stay smart. And if you haven't had physics yet, take a class in physics. explain how and why it's different for you until you actually do it. Then you'll understand, and then you'll be sort of in the physics club. And whether or not you ever do physics again for the rest of your life, it'll change you, I promise. Guys, stay strong, stay creative. We need more of that in this world.
Thanks, catch you next time.
We'd like to take a moment to thank you, the listener, for joining us on this week's episode of the Poolside Polymaths podcast. A big thank you goes to our writers and our production team, Matt, Trish, Pavan, Louis, and Flavio. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn at SciArtParty. For more content on the topics covered in this episode, check out our website, www.sciartparty.com. Make sure to subscribe on whatever platform you listen to your favorite podcasts, and join us next time for more conversations by the poolside.
Neil deGrasse Tyson has now become Einstein.
Thin silk undergarment.
Jeez Louise.